Good day, everyone. By popular demand, I'm going to discuss this morning Reform Judaism and how it came about and what the issues are, how they differ, how it progressed, evolved, and then began to devolve into something that is arguably healthy or unhealthy in Jewish life. There's an ongoing debate. Would we be better off or worse with or without Reform Judaism? Meaning, positively, it serves as a break against assimilation and disappearance, or does it grease the wheels towards assimilation and disappearance? And if all you had was Torah on the one side and disappearance on the other side, then people would have a more educated choice to make, rather than participate in a movement which, again, arguably makes it a lot easier to assimilate and to disappear. What's the largest movement, by the way, in American Jewish life today? Do you know, by numbers?
Unaffiliated.
Unaffiliated, correct. Most Jews are unaffiliated. But I dare say that the ranks of the unaffiliated are burgeoned by Reform Jews who just no longer participate. Other Jews also, but just no longer feel any affinity for a particular movement. But let me say at the outset, and it's important to emphasize, Reb Nachman of Breslov said that it's not hard to push people away. The real work is to try to draw people near and uplift them. So you shouldn't look at this discourse on Reform Judaism as a tool to disparage them or mock them, etc. It's not true. We have to treat every Jew with love and every Jew with respect. The truth is we can learn things from them also. There's no doubt they have a much greater sensitivity to the needs of the general community, global affairs, etc., even what they loosely call Tikkun Olam, than Torah Jews do. We're much more parochial. They're much more universalistic. And there's a value to being universalistic. Not the only value, of course, but there is a value to it. So there are things we could learn from them, but you shouldn't take this as a polemic just against them and attacking them. So how did they begin? Like, what would possess a group of Jews to try to separate themselves from the world of Torah? Well, I want to rely, by the way, on their sources, in particular two works written by Reform rabbis, one by David Philipson called Reform Movement in Judaism, and the other by Bernard Martin called Contemporary Reform Jewish Thought. They're not new books, they go back quite a while. The first one goes back to 1930, the latter one to the 60s, but nonetheless to see how they perceived what they were doing, how it came about, and, I have to say, how it's contributed to the Churban in American Jewish life today. So Reform Judaism arose in the late 18th century, and it was a direct response to what was happening in Western Europe, especially the currents surrounding the French Revolution, but not limited to France. Of course, it started in Germany. What happened was, for the first time in the late 18th century, Jews were being offered an opportunity to become full, equal citizens in the lives of the countries in which they lived, what they called emancipation. Jews never had rights in Europe. We were always second-class citizens, but the influence of the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, etc., you had enough people who had secularized and were no longer committed Christians. They no longer felt the need to persecute Jews or keep them down. So they wanted to integrate Jews into the lives, the civil life of the countries in which they lived. So freedom, emancipation, rights, in the French slogan, liberty, equality, fraternity. So you have a comradeship with your fellow citizens, you have a bond with them, and then what you have to try to do is limit as much as possible points of friction or distinctions between the life of the Jew and the life of everyone else. So the early leaders of Reform Judaism saw that Judaism would be able to accommodate the modern world if they focused on the ideals and values of Judaism. So the original name of Reform Judaism was Prophetic Judaism, meaning they followed the ideals of the Nevi'im, especially Yeshayahu and his vision of universal brotherhood. The ghetto in Western Europe was breaking down. You had in 1791, for example, in France, the Declaration of the Rights of Man, and the French Parliament voted narrowly to allow full citizenship for Jews. You found, therefore, that reform took root in the places where emancipation was a factor: Germany, France, Austria, Hungary, etc. Where did it not take root at all? In Eastern Europe, Russia, Poland, Lithuania, because there emancipation was a dead letter. They were ruled by the Tsar, who was a tyrant, and there was no reason to try to find a way of observing Judaism while still accommodating the modern world. So right away, with emancipation, there was a consequence. Once full civil life was available to Jews, the only barrier then would be the distinctiveness of Jewish life. Meaning, you can't fully be part of the world if you can't, just off the top of our heads, you can't marry your fellow citizens. Your Shabbos is different than the Sabbath of the non-Jews. You can't eat the foods that they eat. So there really were two mechanisms that they saw that would enable them to participate fully in Jewish life. One was conversion to Christianity, which happened in large numbers in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. And the other way was reform, meaning reform Judaism, I use it here as a verb, reform, change it, modify it, so that it'll be compatible with the new freedoms in Western Europe. Many converted, to be sure, by the thousands, but more chose the option of reform. And therefore, Philipson, for example, vehemently rejected the notion that Reform Judaism was intended to assimilate the Jews or to smooth the road to conversion. So practically, that was the inevitable consequence. But the early leaders of Reform actually saw it as an alternative to conversion to Christianity, somehow to keep Jews Jews. So how then do you remove the barriers? I mentioned a few examples already. So what they did at the outset is they scorned any type of observance that made Jews appear to be separate from other people. Now, obviously, that covers a very wide swath of territory. In the ghetto, in Eastern Europe, for example, in the Pale of Settlement, so Jews were isolated from the world. We really, in Eastern Europe, we lived our own lives. The non-Jews wanted little to do with us. The Jews wanted even less to do with the non-Jews. So basically, you had commercial relations, but you really had no social intercourse of any kind. The Jews didn't have to relate. In Western Europe, it became different. So they said, I'm quoting now, many Jewish customs, food habits, their special speech, Jews had to abandon that because all of these intensified the isolation. So the language of Jews was Yiddish in Europe. They hated Yiddish with a passion. And they embraced basically German or French, depending on where they lived. Food habits, meaning kashrus. So that became a relic. And many other Jewish customs, which pretty quickly began to strip Yadus of its uniqueness. So the aim really wasn't to modernize as much as it was to make Judaism more universal and less parochial. Now, when it started, late 18th, early 19th centuries, the Rabbanim of the time were obviously negative, but their response was not always the most effective. And really, the first person who took on the Reform movement about 50 years too late. Can't blame him. He wasn't active before. And that's Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch in Frankfurt, where he took on actively the Reform movement and began writing and teaching how their view of Judaism is not just apikarsut, but how it's counterproductive and how it will lead to disappearance. And we have to understand how every mitzvah, the Torah is a holistic system, and every mitzvah, halacha, even every minhag, somehow fits into the general system. Rav Kook later, a century later, criticized the Rabbanim for not being concerned enough with the material welfare of the Jews. And in fact, it was true. In the 19th century, poverty became almost a virtue in Jewish life. You know, they prided themselves on not being materialistic. The problem is, you'll have a certain subset of people, probably a majority, who don't want to live impoverished lives. They don't want to live in hunger, and they want to be able to support their families and even enjoy themselves. Reform promised, almost guaranteed, that there'd be an avenue to achieve that. Of course, you'd have to jettison certain Jewish practices, but they offered people the opportunity to remain Jews on the one hand, but on the other hand, they could go to university, and they could have businesses, and they could become productive as well. Many Rabbanim properly saw the danger of emancipation and enlightenment, but they could not properly formulate a response to it until Rav Hirsch came along. And then in the 1830s, 1840s, he showed how Jews could embrace emancipation. Rav Hirsch, by the way, was a parliamentarian. He was part of the Moravian Parliament. So Rav Hirsch was able to show how a Jew could be part of the world and still remain loyal to Torah. It was about a half century too late. By the way, where else do we see this? Because a lot of these disputes, you know, they're just a perennial in Jewish life. You see this even today. It's the difference in the Orthodox world between those who have a greater comfort with the modern world, called the modern Orthodox, centrist Orthodox, and those who have a discomfort with the modern world, the Haredi world, the Yeshivish world. So, but if anything, the modern Orthodox have showed that for the most part, you can remain a committed Torah Jew, following the halacha, and also partake of the modern world. Not partake of every aspect, of course, but nonetheless partake of it, so you shouldn't feel any type of deficiency. The Rabbanim of the time overestimated the depth of the commitment of their followers, and so they did not know how to exploit emancipation, and some saw it as a trick to lure Jews away from Torah. Now, to give you one very telling example, Napoleon, the French emperor, in the second decade of the 19th century, went to war, wanted to conquer all of Europe. He had a Napoleon complex, by the way. So Napoleon went to conquer, and he came to Russia. Now, most Jews greeted him as a savior, because the Tsar was horrible. The Tsar persecuted Jews. And here Napoleon was presiding over a France that had emancipated Jews and given them full civil rights. The Balatanya, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, opposed Napoleon and supported the Tsar. So there's a big dispute amongst the Rabbanim, because most Rabbanim were against Napoleon, or against the Tsar, and supported Napoleon. He was against Napoleon and supported the Tsar. Why? Because he held somewhat astutely that the Tsar, as bad as he is, and as harsh as his decrees are, will not take Jews away from Torah. In fact, he'll enforce a ghetto existence, but at least Jews can be Shomrei Mitzvot. Whereas Napoleon is going to seduce Jews away from Torah. So therefore, he felt better to be under the thumb of the Tsar than to be under the rule of Napoleon. Eventually, Napoleon was defeated on the gates of Moscow, beaten by the Russian winter, by the way, and then he met his Waterloo at Waterloo, and that was it soon after that. But you see, I'm not saying who's right and who's wrong. You never know. But you see the two sides of the machloket here between the Balatanya and others. By the way, you should know that the Balatanya was saved in Khaslovich. He was hidden by the local Rav there, who was Misnaged. It's a famous story, by the way. He hid him, and when the French army came around and searched all of Khaslovich, they wanted to arrest the Lubavitcher Rebbe, they came to his house, and they asked the Rav, do you know where he is? So he said, if I knew where he was, I would hand him over to you myself, that Apikaris. And of course, he had hidden him in his basement. So he was saved. In Khaslovich, thereafter, they had a minig. It became a Chabad town. They had a minig that the Rav of the town would always be a misnaged, out of deference to the savior of the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, and that's our Moshe Soloveitchik. The Rav's father became the Rav in Khaslovich. In any event, the response to the initial deviations which took place in their temples, the main deviations at first were changing the Nusach HaTfilah, shortening the davening, using an organ, which mimicked the Protestant temples, and saying the entire davening in German, not Hebrew. That was met in 1819 by a kolkore, by the Rabbanim, both in Germany and elsewhere, called Eila Divrei Habrit. Here's the cover of the Sefer that came out. And the cover summarizes the cherem and the denunciation. And they write that they're doing this to lahafer dat chadasha, in order to nullify the new religion that has arisen, the new religion being Reform Judaism. These three things: also l'shanot seder atfilah nehuga b'Yisrael min birchot hashachar ad achar leil shabeach u'mikol shekein shein legra mimeno. You're not allowed to change the Seder HaTfilah that's customary amongst the Jewish people from Birchot HaShachar until later, meaning everything. You certainly can't take things away. What had they done? They had started to change the Nusach HaTfilah and take things away. By the way, is that Asur? What?
I mean, seemingly not. Not completely. It's
you're right.
It may not get best.
If a person, let's say you're running late, and you want to catch up, and you say Baruch Shamar Asher Yishtabach, all right, Yotzei, okay? You can't say it's also to do, but that's what they said. They made it in the language of Isser. Second, Asulat Paleil Seidat Tfilah Halos Bilashon Acher Chutz Bilashon Hakodesh. You can't daven in any other language but Hebrew. What's halacha?
I mean, I think that is explicitly pretty explicit, you absolutely could impact it.
That's correct. Halacha is explicit. It's clear. You're allowed to daven in any language. There's certain things, in Mishnah and Sota, what has to be B'Lashon HaKodesh. But tefillah is not among them. Third, also l'nagei b'beit ha'kneset b'shum kli shir b'shabbat u'v'yom ta'afilah al-day enu Yisrael. You're not allowed to play any musical instrument in a shul on Shabbat or Yom Tov, even if a non-Jew is playing. All right, what's halacha?
Okay, that's actually stepping into Derabanan territory.
Yes, well, you have a minig, Zechel Churban, not to ever have a musical instrument in shul.
No, but like they said on Shabbos, right?
On Shabbos Yom Tov. What if a non-Jew plays?
Then it's kind of like Derabanan.
Okay. I'm not arguing with you. I think it's correct. By the way, it's a famous tshuva of the Ramah. I think he excerpted it in his in the Mapan, the Shulchan Aruch. He used to get married Friday afternoon, all right, because they're all poor. And this way you save a meal. You can make the first Sudat Shabbat as well. What about you need music? So Ramah permitted music to be played by non-Jews at a Friday night wedding. Whatever it is, you see that what they did, Asur, they put in a halachic context what was not necessarily all clear halacha, but just to draw a line, a red line around these practices in the hopes of isolating them. Now, this was already 1819. 20 years earlier, well, go back even before that. One other thing they did, was they started to pray in German. So this already was a consequence of Moses Mendelssohn, who had translated the Chumash into the German language, the Beur, and that elevated German language and culture and made the Torah respectable. That's what Mendelssohn did. He made the Torah respectable in German intellectual circles. However, he, of course, was religious, but he unleashed tremendous havoc in Jewish life, and mixed signals were sent as well, so much so that I think all of his grandchildren were actually Christians. His main disciple, David Friedlander, who was one of the leaders of Reform Judaism, in 1799 offered to convert to Christianity with an entire group of Jews, wholesale conversion, as long as the German Christians would dispense with their distinctive Christian practices, meaning give up their holidays, give up the Trinity, and give up as well the divinity of Jesus. Well, the Christians had at least the self-respect to reject his offer, but what's telling is not that he wanted to convert, but that he essentially saw his Judaism as really no different from a de-Christianized Christianity. And that, of course, became a constant issue. Already in the 19th century, we'll find that the German temples began to openly mimic the Protestant temples of the time. So if you're praying in German, and you're reading from scripture in German, and the men are sitting bareheaded, and then already a few decades later, men and women are sitting together in the pews, so what really is the difference between Reform Judaism as practiced in the temples and Protestantism? And that lesson was also not lost on German Jews. So Reform Judaism early on saw emancipation, political freedom, as a religious value. And so you found, and you find until today, that there is a great emphasis in Reform Judaism that's placed on political action, or social action, or human rights. All that is an outgrowth of the original value that dominated the movement. Of course, the Holocaust, which began in Germany, mocked the vision, the utopian vision of the Reform, and so that is something with which they have to wrestle. It's interesting that early Reform Judaism did not reject the idea of revelation. Today, almost all do. They'll play around with the words, you know, what revelation means. They speak now of an ongoing revelation. Most originally accepted the divine authorship of the Torah, or at least the divine authorship of the Ten Commandments. But already by the mid-19th century, when biblical criticism became more popular, then already they began to deny the Torah and Hashemayim and deny revelation as well, in which case you wonder, like, why would anybody do anything? And they began as well to express disdain and contempt for what they called rabbinic Judaism, contempt for the Talmud, for the Torah Shebaal Peh, for ceremonies, for the legal structures of Jewish life. And they began to denounce halacha as medieval, as obscurantist, as unworthy of an enlightened personality. And all this caught on. So again, I'm quoting Philipson, Reform began as a result against the Jewish legal system. They felt compelled to break away from inherited laws and deny its authority. And this became the key. Ideals and ethical devotion are the essential, and the ceremonials are only auxiliary. Certain ceremonies can be adopted or rejected if they promote or cease to promote basic ideas and attitudes. Meaning they subjected the Mesorah to their own formula. Does it advance the ideals of Judaism? Does it make a Jew more comfortable in the world, or does it impair the development of Judaism and make it more difficult for a Jew to be in the world. Eventually, they denied the Masorah, and yet they made these quasi-comical attempts to present themselves as within the realm of tradition. Like even today, they'll say, Reform Judaism doesn't repudiate tradition, but it stresses the principle of tradition. Whatever that means. And sometimes the words have no meaning at all. They don't accept the Masorah as we see it. They felt, once you deny Torah HaShemayim, then basically anything can go. So, for example, certain things rub them the wrong way. They claimed halacha was always influenced by the environment. So Purim was a Babylonian feast that was given a Jewish dress. That's a quote. There are always cross-cultural influences in Jewish life. You see, by the way, two things that are happening now in Reform Judaism. They struggle with both Hanukkah and Purim because both of them involved military action and defeat of enemies, very anti-pluralistic, and they're just offended by the very notion that it should exist. And they took, in the outset, again, we're talking the 1800s now, they took certain halachic constructs totally out of context, but they made them uniform. Like, for example, Horat Shah, meaning you can suspend, say, a Nisa Darabanan, sometimes even a Daraita, in an emergency circumstance. Pikuach Nefesh. But once you say that Pikuach Nefesh means you have to work on Shabbos, or Horat Shah means you have to work on Shabbat, then you've expanded the notion of Horat Shah beyond its natural confines. Or, Pasuk says, Eit lasot l'Hashem heferu taratecha. Time comes when you have to violate the Torah in order to save the Torah. Well, they love that pasuk because you can apply it to anything. You have to violate the Torah to save the Torah. And they use the examples, you know, Pesach Sheni, to this day you hear, Pruzbul, etc. There was no Milah throughout the 40 years in the desert. Meaning it's not a requirement of Jewish life. That could be optional. They love this one as well. Ein gozrim gzeir latzibur, elam kein, rov hatzibur yechol lamod ba. You can't ordain a decree against the tzibur that most of the tzibur cannot accept, cannot tolerate. What does it mean? So it means, of course, a gzera, a takana, something new. But they applied it to halacha. I mean, you can't impose on people something that they can't accept. These days, they apply it to intermarriage as well. As if intermarriage is some type of decree, well, the tzibur can't handle it anymore, therefore it has to lapse. But they used all these principles that really are drawn from the Talmud that they rejected in order to justify changes in existing practices just because people could no longer follow them. And of course, they criticized what they felt was the excessive legalisms and legislation that existed in Jewish life. There's a very famous Reform rabbi in Germany in the mid-1800s, Samuel Holdheim, and he was responsible for many of the changes that some exist for a long time, some they abandoned. For example, he moved Shabbat to Sunday. So again, if you're observing Shabbat on Sunday in a temple where everything's in German and men and women are together and there's no kippah, it's no different than a Protestant church. You might as well go there. Holdheim was among those who banned Milah as a barbaric ancient practice incompatible with modern life. And he said that the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times, is also a revelation of God. And this was a new philosophy, that revelation did not just take place at Sinai. There was a Maimon Har Sinai, but that Maimon Har Sinai was the first of the revelations. And God is an ongoing revelation, and in the spirit of reason, enlightenment, etc., that is also part of the divine revelation that transcends the old. Now, it's accurate to say without being polemical, that Reform Judaism was a declaration of war against the Torah, against the Halacha, and against the Mesorah, and they recognized it. Philipson, there's an irreconcilable conflict between Rabbinism and Reform. And you'll note, Rav Hirsch, in 1836, wrote the 19 letters. Anyone ever hear of it? The 19 letters? You have. You must read it. I read it when I was your age, actually. A fabulous work. It's a discussion between a rabbi and a teenager who wants to assimilate, who finds Judaism much too restrictive. And some of it is, I would say, a very small segment of it is, you know, more appropriate to that era, but 98% speaks directly to us. You should get it. In Hebrew, he got Safon, but he wrote it in English. He wrote in German, rather, but Feldheim has two translations of it. It's well worth it. 19 letters exchanged between a rabbi and a teenager. In any event, they soon declared that the Shulchan Aruch has no binding authority in Jewish life, and they said it's because you have so many examples where halachot are no longer binding, all right? But they didn't really give examples. I mean, they mentioned, for example, karbanot. So we don't have karbanot. But that's not really an example of halacha not being binding. That's an example of halacha that circumstances preclude its execution. Meaning, there's no Beit HaMikdash, so we can't offer karbanot. It's not as if the halacha lapsed. Once the Mesorah was rejected, so everything became up for grabs, and the changes did come slowly, starting in the temple. It's another thing that's important, because they made the temple the center of Jewish life, all right? Would we say that in the Torah world? What's the center of Jewish life? What do you think? Well, it's the geographical center of Israel. The center of Jewish life is always a Jewish home. We go to shul, but no one would say that the shul is the spiritual center of Jewish life. The home is the spiritual center of Jewish life. But once you made, almost like the Christians did, the church is the center, you go there once a week, there you get your spiritual inspiration, and the rest of the time, you can do whatever you want. So that's a sea change. That's a paradigmatic change in the way Judaism is to be understood. They rejected nationalism as a value. So until 1948, it's safe to say that the Reform movement officially was anti-Zionist. They rejected Shivat Zion, they rejected Mashiach, rejected Malchut Beit David, they omitted all those parts of the David, including the bracha etzemach David avdecha meir tatzmech. They got rid of all of that. They even rejected Galut as a concept, as a punishment. Again, I'm quoting Philipson. Jews are a religious community, not a nation. The Jew is a loyal citizen of the nation in which he resides and of no other nation. The career in Palestine, meaning our life in the land of Israel, was but a preparation for Israel's work in all parts of the world. It's complete lehepech, complete transformation of the Torah reality, so much so that you had two American Reform rabbis in the 19th century, one Lilienthal and the other Einhorn, who turned Tisha B'Av into a chag, into a celebration, because they say the greatness, the joy of Tisha B'Av is that it spread Jews all over the world, and we were no longer limited to one land. Here's Lilienthal, Reform rabbi in Cincinnati, 1855. He abolished it. He considered the destruction of Yerushalayim reason for rejoicing rather than mourning, as it was the cause of Jews spreading all over the world and carrying the light of monotheism. So they're anti-Zionist until the State of Israel came into existence, and then you have something very interesting happening now. Because it's hard to say, as we speak, that Reform Judaism today is a Zionist movement. They have such antipathy towards many aspects of the State of Israel I mean, they're pro-Palestinian, pro-two-state delusion. They are not classical supporters of the Jewish national idea. So you find today, that's why, it should be known to all of us, sometimes you read in the paper, they'll write about how American Jews say X or Y, and they've turned on Israel. There's a kara, there's a breach between support in America, amongst American Jews for Israel. No. First of all, it's because they reverted to their prior state of being uncomfortable with the Jewish national idea. And the second point is one we'll get back to, and that is the sad reality that more, by their own admission, more than half Reform Jews today are not Jewish according to halacha, meaning they only have a Jewish father. Yes?
I'm not sure that Reform Jews, are anti-Zionist. I think you can be Zionist yet pro-Palestinian rights.
So I also have a lot of Reform friends and stuff on their Instagrams all the time. I see that being Jewish does not mean being Zionist. So I would agree with that statement that there are definitely them out there that would say that they would not like to be affiliated.
That's correct. So these are the two sides. I wouldn't say they're anti-Zionist. I would say that they have a discomfort with the Jewish national idea, because it poses problems with them, and there's no doubt, because their primary value system today is universalistic, all right? Progressive, the very idea of a state that's based on a religious affiliation or national identity is a direct confrontation to that. Yes?
I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that a good Israel, which is like the Orthodox communities, specifically rejects Zionism.
No, it's not true. They're non-Zionist.
They're non-Zionist.
They're not anti-Zionist. The Satmar is anti-Zionist, but not Aguda. Aguda's in the government. They can't be anti-Zionist. But as someone once said, I think somebody even says to Ben Gurion, anyone who says Baruch Ata Hashem Machazir Shechinato LeZion is a Zionist. It's those who don't say that that might not be Zionists. They just have a different conception. They're against secular Zionism. As a technical matter, they're against religious Zionism. We shouldn't think for a moment they're against the Jewish national idea. Rather, they see the Jewish national idea as only being fully articulated in a Torah state. That's different. That's not being uncomfortable with the Jewish national idea. In any event, you had these deviations that came about in the 19th century. I mentioned in the temples, they abolished any tefillah that made reference to national institutions, reference to the land of Israel. Again, the Rabbanim of the time did not really, except for Rav Hirsch, they just chose to, besmirch them. The Chtam Sofer said they're infidels. The Maram Shik said they're the same as Gayim. Rav Mordechai Banet said they're neither Jews nor Christians, they just have no faith. Yes?
Run by the foundation, the Federation of Cincinnati, which just has a ton of money in their endowment they just have to get rid of every year. And so this fellowship, their goal with it was to bring different teenage people from high schools and stuff who could create some sort of leadership program in which they would draw in other Jewish youth who had no background, and instead of trying to recruit them to a specific sect of Judaism, just to give them options of different youth groups and see maybe if they would be interested in doing something. It was really to build relationships and not to do recruitment.
Right.
Their idea was, and then let it go from there, and hopefully they'd have some sort of Jewish...
Look, I don't doubt at all what you're saying is true, and that decades...
But I was just going to say, I asked one of the... Because I was trying to get a better handle on Reform and stuff, because I didn't really understand it. And one of the girls in it ended up doing... This was her second or third year of the fellowship, and she was on regional boards and stuff for NIFTY, which is the Reform version of NCSY, if you can call it that. And I said, what is Reform Judaism to you? What does it mean? And she was like, well, it's like, we don't have to, argue about whether or not we believe Moshe existed or whatever, but it's just kind of like we're all Jewish, and that's what matters.
It's a cultural thing, right. See, there's no doubt that for decades, after the state was founded, until maybe 10, 15 years ago, Israel was the major component in establishing Jewish identity in young people. outside the Orthodox world. I mean, amongst, in our world, it's also important, but you can't say it's the major source of identity. For Israel, it was the major source of identity. So what's happening, both in terms of the growth amongst Reform Judaism, of halachic non-Jews who feel two identities, a Jewish and a non-Jewish one, concomitant with that, you're going to find that there is a diminution in their affiliation towards Israel. And add to that as well the rise of progressivism in American Jewish life, which makes Israel always appear to be the aggressor because it's nationalistic and it's religious, etc. So both of those things combine in order to reduce their attachment to Israel. And that's why I say the growing discomfort with the Jewish national idea that they have, which was a founding principle of Reform Judaism, has come back, maybe for different reasons, but it's come back again. So I mentioned before, in the 19th century, they changed Shabbat to Sunday. They got rid of Yom Tov Sheni Shel Goliot. I know that people want to do that also, by the way. They attacked Mila, got rid of it, rejected Mashiach. They adopted already the 19th century. They still have this today. The triennial cycle of Torah reading, meaning they just read a third of the Sedra each week. And that's they finish every 3 years. All those things didn't help. And everything was an outgrowth of a sequence of Reform conferences they had in Germany in the mid-1840s. And each one added new heresies to the Torah in Brunswick and Frankfurt and Breslau to discuss what they should accept and what they should reject. So, for example, in Brunswick, they raise questions that you can think about, like I said before, in reference to the rabbinic response. Why do you need Chazarat Hashatz? Why? All right? It's for to be motzi, those who are not bucky. Well, if you're reading in German anyway, everyone's a bucky. Why have it? How to make shofar more pleasing, more aesthetically pleasing. Dalet meaning they got rid of. Why do you need seven kruim, seven aliyot to the Torah? Why Hebrew? Why Mashiach? Why an organ? How do we reconcile Shabbat with modern life? So they said, we will preserve Shabbat observance without Shabbat rest. And all these were discussions that went on and on. In Frankfurt, why do you have to read the Torah again for Maftir? All right? Why do we have to mention anything about Tzion in the davening if now it's considered archaic? So you had major fights also. You had a more traditional and a more radical element. In Breslau, in 1846, the fights broke out into the open about observance of Shabbat, because obviously you can't live a modern life and be part of society and take off Shabbat. They concluded that they would return to a biblical Shabbat, meaning the Lametet Melachot, or we're biblical, as the forget the Lametet, as the Torah says it, all right? The Torah's view of Melach on Shabbos, this week's Sedra, Lo Taseh Kol Melacha. It's actually quite indefinite, very ambiguous. So that's what they would embrace. Nonetheless, all these things just gave rise to further and further deviations from Jewish law. You know what didn't take place? It's so interesting in retrospect. What they call today the women's issues, all right? That didn't happen at all because the culture did not support it. The first Reform female rabbi was actually Regina Jonas. I never heard of her till I was in Berlin about a decade ago in the Orenburgstrasse synagogue. It's called the Naya Synagogue, the new synagogue. It was a big Reform temple, and it had a museum there, and that's where I heard her story. She went to the Hochschul, the Academy for the Science of Judaism, want to become a rabbi. They said, no, you can't. Women can't become rabbis. She found a rabbi in the 1930s who would ordain her, and she actually wrote the thesis on why ordination of women is acceptable according to halacha. So she was ordained. That particular temple did not hire. She never found a temple. As it turns out, Nebuch, She was sent to Theresienstadt, and she was killed and murdered in Auschwitz in 1943. But none of these were hot issues, except for mixed seating. None of these were hot issues until the 20th century. Among the things that happened, odd if you think about it, actually they got rid of Shalosh Ani Ishes of Bracha, but Halacha distinguishes between men and women, correct? Why should women be set aside for a ptur from mitzvot aseh shezman grama? From time they got rid of that. Women are as obligated as men. I'm not sure they're all happy about that. They actually made a bat mitzvah, age 13 also. Can't distinguish. Women in the minyan, so all these things came later in the 20th century. In any event, Reform Judaism was transported from Germany, mainly in France, to America in the mid-19th century. It's a tremendous influx of German Jews. By the way, early American Jewry was almost always Sephardi. Spanish Portuguese from the Netherlands and elsewhere. So the early like Spanish Portuguese synagogue is the oldest. Even the Torah synagogue was founded by Sephardic Jews. It wasn't until the mid-19th century with an influx of German Jews who brought Reform Judaism with them. That's a whole separate chapter, how it evolved in American Jewish life, became quite radical, in fact. It was the 1860s. Isaac Meir Weiss began what was called the Friday Night Service, which since then has been the staple of Reform services on Shabbat, for those who are working on Shabbat. You had the Pittsburgh Platform in 1885 that codified the basic principles of Reform Judaism. Only moral laws are binding. No ritual is binding. No nationalism, no kashrut, no kuna, no Beit HaMikdash, Tchiyat HaMetim, Mashiach. None of that exists at all. And they modified it from time to time. Today it's basically driven by causes and issues that are associated with the political left and not necessarily Jewish, except if you draw the circle very wide. And they're caught really in a paradox, which is, if you reject the Masorah, so why should you have any ceremonies? In fact, why should you listen to your rabbis? Because Lo Tasur is also from the Torah. You don't accept the Torah, you don't accept Lo Tasur. And so such a disconnect then between what the rabbis used to say and even what they say today and what they actually do. And that's how intermarriage became so prevalent in Reform Jewish life, with intermarriage without a need for conversion. Conversion itself became a farce, requiring no Kabbalat mitzvot. In Reform, they required no mila for men, no mila tvila for women. I'm sorry, no mila for women. Yeah, they were very strong about that. No mila tvila for men, no tvila for women. It just, you know, you raise your hand and take a vow and that's it. But it required really nothing. And then, of course, 1983, the natural consequence was the resolution of patrilineal descent, which meant that, actually a very anti-feminist resolution, Jewish status is conveyed through the mother. And now they said that Jewish status will be conveyed even through one parent, whether mother or father. The only natural born Jew is one who has two Jewish parents, all right? But note, it's a clever thing, if you have one Jewish mother, but are not raised, one Jewish mother, if you have a Jewish mother, but are not raised as a Jew, you're not considered Jewish according to Reform. Meaning one parent suffices, but the parent has to raise you as a Jew. Yes?
Well, how do they define race as a Jew?
What's that?
How do they define race as a Jew?
Very loosely. If you join the temple, that would suffice. If you observe the holiday, that would suffice. But Lemaisa doesn't matter, because such a person with a Jewish father could marry another offspring of a Jewish father, and they perform the ceremony, and neither is Jewish. Neither is Jewish. But nonetheless, it was done not for hashkafic reasons, ideological reasons. It was done because the numbers were hemorrhaging. They're losing thousands, tens of thousands, and hundreds of thousands. So to this day, I mean, Rick Jacobs said this 5-6 years ago. He's the head of the one of the Reform Jewish organizations. More than 50% of the movement is now not considered halachic Jews. So to him, it's a source of pride, because that was the whole universalistic approach of the early Reform. But it's a problem, because now we are two different peoples. We're not really united by anything, certainly not by Torah or Mesorah, but not even by a shared heritage, because we don't have it. Yes? Yes.
What do you, what major evolutions do you see Reform Jews?
Next 30 years, what major evolutions do I see in Reform Jewish life? Here's one. You can take it to the bank. There will be first an informal, but soon after formal, merger between the Reform and conservative movements. Yes, it's because they're both losing numbers. In America today, because they're drive on Shabbat, conservative temples are closing down and consolidating, all right? Because you can drive from anywhere. So instead of each little town having a temple, they don't have the numbers to support it. It's their population. Now, they'll claim on the books a certain number of members, but Lemaisa, how many people are actually coming Friday night? Paying dues is enough, right? How many people are coming to participate? Yeah, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur are still popular days. But I know this from people I know who unfortunately, they went off the derech and married such a family. They went to the temple on Yom Kippur, and Yom Kippur ended like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And they went to break their fast at a treif restaurant. That's what we're talking about. Yes? Cincinnati was the flagship of Reform Judaism in America.
I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, there's like probably four or five like operating synagogues that have like worship like every Saturday and stuff. But like across the country, it's so small.
Right. Take another issue I didn't raise yet. They abolished long ago the idea of a get, saying civil divorce suffices. All right. So the good news is, their kiddushin is not a kiddushin. The bad news is, if in fact someone married kalacha and then did not get a get because they don't believe in it, and they subsequently remarry, that only increases the possibility of mamzerut later on, which is a terrible thing. All right, look, yes. Sure, you are. Howie Jackter, right.
Yeah, I think he has said pretty much categorically, like, all, like, non-Orthodox weddings at this point are, like, invalid.
Yes, I could believe that, right, because they don't have valid edim. I'm talking something else. Let's say people marry kalacha, and then they become reformed for whatever reason. Or take a case that wasn't uncommon when I was young, that people would, they would marry Orthodox for the parents or grandparents. I'm not going to a Reform wedding. They grab an Orthodox rabbi. So it turns out that the kiddushin is a good kiddushin, but they're not religious. And if they come to divorce, the grandparents don't care to arrange a get. They only care about the wedding. And now you have a big problem with Mazer if they marry later on. By the way, even if they don't marry later on, a woman married kalacha, doesn't get a get, even lives with me, has a child, child's a mamzer. Yes?
Do you see the Reform movement?
I don't think it's dangerous at all to religious Jews. I think that train sailed. There was a time, train sailed, train can't sail, that boat sailed. That train left, nobody corrected me. That train left the station. There was a time when it was a factor. That's decades ago, maybe more than a half century, because we showed that we can be part of the world, we can be doctors and lawyers and businessmen, etc., and still be Shomer Shabbat. It's unnecessary. This becomes the greater challenge, the conservative movement, which posited they want to retain a fidelity halacha, but they want to modernize, they want to evolve. That we'll discuss next time, because the way we live our lives as Torah Jews, comfortable in a Western milieu, that itself is a challenge to them that they can't understand. Meaning we've made them unnecessary. Their reason for existence is unnecessary. And that problem is also yet to be resolved. And they, because they've adopted this flexible approach to halacha, that's why they have the same problems. They're about 10 years behind in all the reform innovations, but they're suffering the same effects of assimilation and intermarriage. Okay, yes. Yeah, that's not. I don't think it's going to work necessarily. But look, I'll tell you what. I mean, I've met Reform rabbis. Many of them are sincere. Like, they want to really help Jews and the Jewish people. They're just clueless how to do it. And of course, that becomes a greater problem in Jewish life. So it remains an open question. I know amongst my colleagues, we debate it all the time. Those who see Reform Judaism as having positive elements, because it prevents assimilation, and those who see it as negative, because it aids, it facilitates assimilation, because it presents an alternate view of Judaism. But free people can differ. My own view happens to be that in terms of Kiruv, it makes it more difficult. Because you have to, Mira Chait said this once, because you have to then, there's a difference between teaching a blank slate or teaching someone has false ideas. Someone has false ideas, you have to unlearn them before you teach them what's correct. A blank slate is a blank slate. What they've basically done is created an alternative Jewish people and an alternative Torah. Meaning, you speak to a Reform Jew, I don't have to observe Shabbos. I'm allowed to eat pork because I'm Reform, and therefore it's permissible to me. Of course, it's a complete lie. It's totally bogus. But where pluralism is a value, then you're going to find it becomes much more difficult to tell people, no, you've been taught something false and harmful, and it makes it much more difficult to bring them back. The bottom line is, we have to do whatever we can. I believe it's important, one Jew at a time. Rather than deal with organizations and rabbis, if you know people, you meet them in college, etc., reach out to them, show them how beautiful Torah is, how it benefits our lives, and connects us to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and then one by one, we'll be able to save what we can. All right, I thank you all very much.